Well, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what started happening on the 12th of February, because that's really the start of the recent uprising. And can you maybe compare it to the unrest that we've been following since April 2000? Because there is a difference, if I understand your article correctly, isn't there?
There is definitely a difference between the water wars in Cochabamba of 2000 and the uprising in La Paz on February 12th, which also spread to Santa Cruz, the other major city in Bolivia, as well as Oruro, a minor city in Bolivia. In April 2000, it stayed confined to Cochabamba, and the objective was to, of course, to prevent the privatization of water, which was going to raise the what people were paying for the use of water. Was going to raise that something like 35%.
And it was going to be essentially one-fifth of people's average income they were going to have to pay just for water, correct?
Exactly, and of course in the hands of a transnational, Bechtel, based in San Francisco, so on and so forth. And they roundly defeated them. So that was one of the first victories in Latin America against the neoliberal privatization program that was instituted after the mid-80s but really took off in the 1990s. So it was very clearly a rejection of a specific neoliberal privatization measure in which almost the entire citizenry participated. In Cochabamba in 2000, you're looking at levels probably of above 80% of the population, maybe closer to 90%, in revolt and barricades and so on and so forth. But not against the government in power, merely to stop the privatization of water. And, of course, that led to more organizing and a conceptualization of the neoliberal model as a whole and why the model as a whole needed to be rejected instead of just the privatization of water. But nevertheless, what happened on February 12th was very, very different because it involved the destruction of the headquarters of every single major neoliberal party in Bolivia.
And some media outlets as well, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, there was one television station, and the other television stations got scared and went off the air. There was one television station that was attacked in La Paz, and the Ministry of Sustainable Development, which was a neoliberal creation of Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, who's the current president now, it was a creation of his first administration. So the targets, although it was portrayed in the media as, this kind of wild vandalism, bands of young hoods running through the streets, burning and looting, the fact is the targets were extremely specific. In El Alto, the city of about 700,000, which is a predominantly Aymara city, they also targeted the electric company, the water company, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, the mayor's office, and something called Banco Sol, which is a bank for poor people, which is essentially, usury, that was also created during the first Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada administration. So here what you saw in La Paz was, I would say, a much more generalized attack on the entire political economic system. It wasn't just the privatization of water.
I wanted to just go... Oh, I'm sorry for interrupting. I wanted to just go back for 1 second because you mentioned one of the indigenous groups in the area in El Alto. You mentioned it's Aymara community, which makes this, I guess, quite a bit different from what we would picture as a suburban area, because that's essentially it's a city that's very close to the capital, correct?
Correct, but it's also a city. It sits right on the upper edge because La Paz is down in a crater. And the city of El Alto is the edge of the crater. And it's really where the city meets the countryside. So it's an Aymara city in the sense that many, many people in the city of El Alto still have connections to rural areas and still participate in their communities of origin.
But it's not a kind of a rural-based economy. It's more of a suburban, working class is the way to describe it?
It is. It's working class, but many people still have ties to the land. And, you know, there's some light industry, the Coca-Cola bottling plant, the Pepsi bottling plant. There's very little heavy industry. There's some cement. I think there's a cement factory. But you have a lot of small workshops, you know, auto repair, that kind of thing. And it's very much working class, but it's working class that's closely connected to the countryside, which is why the uprising in La Paz has to be looked at not only in terms of La Paz, but also in terms of El Alto, because El Alto is crucial. That's the entrance to La Paz. And when they blocked the entrance to La Paz on the night of February 12th, there was a great deal of fear in La Paz that, you know, El Alto was going to cut La Paz off from the rest of the country, which is what they intended to do, but were unable to do because, of course, the army eventually did respond very brutally.
And as we know, many people were killed. I wonder, I guess we should maybe describe some of the events that actually took place and who it was, because this is an interesting element as well, that started this uprising.
Yeah, it's absolutely crucial because it determined, the way the uprising started kind of determined how long it lasted. The police, a special group within the police, revolted against a tax measure that was extremely unpopular, a 12.5% tax that people could not at all afford. And these special groups within the police, you know, they have the name special groups, but they're paid miserably. They get paid something like $105 per month. And so 12.5% of $105 per month was something that they were not willing to put up with. And the police in Bolivia have in the past, in the recent past, in 2000, they got into a fight with the army here in La Paz. So it's not completely unheard of that the police would protest against a government measure. It sounds very strange to a North American audience to hear, you know, police protesting. But they do that here. And they did that here in the revolution of, National Revolution of 1952. And police revolts were crucial in the National Revolution, just as they were crucial on February 12th. When the special groups within the police began to fight with the army and began to face government sniper fire, because there were snipers who fired on the police, the police left the main government square area where they had been protesting, went back to their headquarters, which they had kind of taken over as a fortress. They were guarding it, you know, from the rooftops and so on. They armed themselves, and then they went back to the government, the main square where the presidential palace is, and they got into actual firefights, gunfights, with the army. But while the police had gone down to get their weapons, and the army had more or less kind of retreated, high school students from a high school near the presidential palace, but students who come from extremely working class backgrounds, smashed all the windows with stones and of the presidential palace, and then the police arrived, and then it was, you know, then it was chaos, or it appeared to be chaos, because there was indeed vandalism and there was indeed looting. But as I said, and the people who were doing it were very young. But as I said, it was not. It would be a mistake to overemphasize that element of kind of random youth violence or looting, because in fact the high school students were very disciplined. The first thing they assaulted was the presidential palace.
Okay, now how does the International Monetary Fund fit into the big picture here of what's going on in Bolivia? Am I correct in understanding that this recent revolt is that, well, you mentioned the neoliberal agenda before, and I understand that the IMF had an idea, or Mr. Sanchez de Lozada decided that he was going to raise income taxes and lower social spending in order to satisfy the IMF, in order to acquire, I guess, some kind of future aid, that being the business that they're in. How do they fit into the big picture here, though?
The IMF has been crucial to the formation of neoliberalism in Bolivia since 1985, which is the year in which Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, who was at that time a senator, along with people like Jeffrey Sachs from Harvard, who designed the shock treatment programs for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. That's the year, 1985 is the year when Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada and people like Jeffrey Sachs designed a neoliberal program according to IMF dictates for Bolivia. So the IMF has had a hand in neoliberalism in Bolivia from that time, and Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada has been the main architect of neoliberalism in Bolivia, always working hand-in-hand with the IMF. And that, you know, whether you talk about privatization, you know, everything he has done, his tax measures, all of his program is pretty much IMF dictated. And this time around, they were either going to do a tax on gasoline, or they were going to do the tax that they decided in favor of instead, this 12.5% income tax. And it was IMF mandated because of the issue of budget deficits, and of course, it's one more attack on people's survival, because it's really, you have to look at this as a riot against the increasing difficulty of simply surviving, because these policemen who started the revolt, as I said, they only make $105 a month, and there are a lot of people who make a lot less. And so the 12.5% tax is really not something that people can afford, but that's not something that concerns the IMF. There are other things that, of course, there are other tax measures that could be passed. They could decide to tax agribusiness in the tropical Santa Cruz region, right? But as long as the IMF is placing what they call conditionalities on the loans, there's no way that they're going to tax anybody in Santa Cruz. They're not going to tax any of the multinational companies that work here. The only people that they're willing to tax are the people who can least afford it. And that comes straight from the IMF.
So how much trouble is the president in here? How much of this is a threat to his, how much is this a threat to his government? And also, do you think he's going to honor his promise to, I understand he rescinded his tax policy shortly after the outbreak of unrest in the middle of the month. Do you think he's going to live up to his promise there?
No, there's no question. There's no question that in one form or another, these tax measures will be back, because the IMF really doesn't leave the government with many alternatives. If they're going to get those loans, which are conditional upon, you know, certain measures, there's really, one way or another, they're going to have to impose some kind of tax, and they will face conflict in the future. As to whether he can hold on or how long he can hold on, I think is really the question, because I would be very surprised if he was able to finish out his term. There are some events from January that are crucial to the uprising in February. The coca growers, who are under very severe pressure from the U.S. Embassy, blockaded the roads, as they do periodically when they find that their dialogues with the government are going absolutely nowhere. This began in the middle of January, and the coca growers have been really the leading kind of vanguard social movement in Bolivia since neoliberalism, because the advent of neoliberalism in 1986 brought about the destruction of the Bolivian miners' movement, which was probably the most radical working class movement in Latin America until 1986, and the coca growers were the only social movement that were really able to respond to the neoliberal challenge throughout the 1990s. And their leader, Evo Morales, came in second in the recent presidential elections and was really, if I remember correctly, only 1 or 2 percentage points behind Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. Now, the first time that Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada governed, he governed with a tremendous amount of legitimacy, and he was able to isolate the coca growers as a kind of sectoral or regional movement. But now the coca growers are trying to assume national leadership of a movement to overthrow neoliberalism. The movement has come a very long way. There are still some very serious barriers to unity, and when the coca growers blockaded the roads in the middle of January, it was clear that their failure to make an alliance beforehand with the Aymara peasants of the highlands meant that the blockade was destined to failure through strangulation, through government strangulation. The government was able to isolate them. But that's the crucial background to what happened in February. Because in January, while there were large parts of the tropical region, as well as the city of Sucre in the south, and certain areas of Potosí, which is a mountainous area also in the south, while those regions were more or less in open revolt, open defiance of government authority against ALCA, I mean the Free Trade Association of the Americas agreement, La Paz was completely dead. There was no response. There was no challenge to the government. Now, all of a sudden, the Bolivian government, 1 month after facing open rebellion in a very significant part of the country, but an open rebellion that was not able to spread to the country as a whole, 1 month after that, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada had to face an urban uprising that began in the seat of state power, began in the right in front of the presidential palace, spread to the vice presidential building, which they burned, then spread to the headquarters of all the neoliberal political parties in the very seat, in the very heart of power in Bolivia. So this is no longer, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada now faces a threat from coca growers, from the Highland Aymara, because there does seem to be now some unity developing between those two movements. And there's also Cochabamba, which has basically been dead for the last year or so, but there's no telling what could happen in Cochabamba. And some of the organizing infrastructure that developed out of April 2000 still exists in Cochabamba. So right now, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada is facing a challenge in major cities as well as the countryside, and he was probably the most successful president in Bolivian history in the 20th century, from 1993 to 1997, and he may well go down this time around as one of the most ineffectual Bolivian presidents. I would be very surprised if he was able to stay in power.
How much does U.S. influence have to do with the reason that this president was able to get elected in the first place? And I think that in order, I can speculate to what I think the answer is. I'd rather hear it from you, obviously. But is it fair to say, first of all, that the U.S. had a tremendous amount of influence in the outcome of this election, the most recent one?
But it might be unintended, because the former U.S. Ambassador Manuel Rocha said, I believe, in the press that Bolivians had best not vote for Evo Morales, or there would be serious consequences. And that really angered a lot of people. And a lot of people voted for Evo Morales, who is the head of Movement Towards Socialism, which is a political party that is trying to project the coca growers movement into a national force, allied with other social movements capable of challenging neoliberalism. Manuel Rocha and the U.S. Embassy had plenty to do with the popularity of the political opposition in Bolivia. So, in a way, it was rather ironic, unintended consequences. But Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada speaks with a very heavy gringo accent. He was educated in the United States. He loves the United States. He probably could not have made a personal fortune of $200 million in the United States. I think it was through privatization of the mines and almost everything else that allowed him to make so much money. So Bolivia has been good to him. But he is very close to the U.S. Embassy, has always been very close to the U.S. Embassy. But to be fair to him, he is not nearly as ignorant as they are, and he realizes that a pause in coca eradication would be the easiest way to diffuse social tension and to guarantee that he is able to stay in power. The U.S. Embassy is deaf to such reasoning and insists on eradicating as much coca as is humanly possible. And as I said, the coca growers movement was the major challenge, the major movement to challenge neoliberalism in Bolivia in the 1990s, because they had smashed the miners' movement. But many of the coca growers are ex-miners, and it's a very strong movement. And they lost their livelihood once as miners. There are a lot of people who are not willing to lose their livelihood again as coca growers. So these are people who are willing to defend the production of the coca leaf, you know, until the death. And the U.S. insists on militarizing the whole issue of the production of the coca leaf. Now, there's some interesting free trade proposals coming from the coca growers who have explored the market in Argentina in just the coca leaf, which has nothing to do with cocaine. And they have found that there's a market for it. They have free trade proposals, but of course, you know, that's illegal. That's not permitted. So really, you have to say that it's the U.S. Embassy that leaves the coca growers with no other option but to go out and block roads, but to try to galvanize a national movement to overthrow neoliberalism and so on. Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada is in the pocket of the U.S. Embassy, but he is much more intelligent than they are and quite a bit more flexible, and were it not for the pressure of the U.S. Embassy, would very likely be willing to entertain the possibility of a pause in the eradication of coca, which is what the coca growers are asking for.
Is that likely to happen, in your estimation?
It's possible.
If that happens, though, I mean, that's going to be the king of ironies, because the United States often, I understand from what I read, holds Bolivia up as a prime example of how their war on drugs is working effectively.
Right, right. Bolivia is the model, because they did in fact eradicate a fantastic amount of coca, although, of course, the previous government of former dictator Hugo Banzer exaggerated greatly the amount of coca that it had eradicated in order to please the U.S. Embassy so that the United States could hold up Bolivia as a model of drug eradication. So there was some playing with the numbers involved in that, you know, great success story. But I think that Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada himself would be willing to agree to some kind of informal pause, where formally he's still eradicating coca, but they're just going a lot slower or something like that, rather than openly defy the U.S. Embassy. He will never do that.
Okay.
Never do that. And in fact, it was when Otto Reich, who is now, I'm not sure what his official position is right now, when he came to Bolivia in October, I believe he was Undersecretary of State for Inter-American Affairs out of the State Department in the United States, couldn't get confirmed. Imagine this. He's such a shady character that he can't get confirmed by the U.S. Senate. So he doesn't have that position anymore. But he had it in October 2002 when he came to Bolivia. And before he came to Bolivia, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada had been saying to Evo Morales, yeah, you know, I'm willing to think about a pause in the eradication, you know, so on and so forth. Once Otto Reich came here, that was it. That was, you know, completely out of the question. So there's no way that officially the government is going to declare a pause. It's possible that informally, you know, they won't keep eradicating at the same pace. But even if they stop or if they slow down, there will be pressure from the U.S. Embassy.
You mentioned the mining industry that was that is now largely, I guess, non-existent there. I thought we should maybe spend a minute talking about this, because in the period, in the immediate post-colonial period, if I understand right, Bolivia was really rich in silver, and this allowed the Spanish a great deal of wealth. But post-colonial Bolivia, tin was the main resource that was mined. And so it's the tin miners that you're referring to, when you say they lost their means of existence once before, you're talking about when the market dropped out of world tin prices, right?
Exactly. And then they privatized the state mines and fired 20,000 workers at one shot.
What year was this?
Tin miners.
What year was
this? 1986.
So that was the beginning of neoliberalism in Bolivia.
Exactly, and Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, as a senator for the MNR party, which is the National Revolutionary Movement Party, he designed what was called the New Political Economy, and he did it with the help of Jeffrey Sachs and the IMF, and one of the things that the New Political Economy involved was the privatization of the mines and the firing of 20,000 workers. And the miners had the strongest tradition of radical trade unionism in Bolivia, but also really they were one of the strongest trade union movements, radical trade union movements in all of Latin America between the period of about 1935 and 1985. And, of course, before that, I mean, Bolivia, of course, now is a fairly marginal country of about 8 million people, which is very much, you know, kind of a peripheral capitalist country, even within Latin America. You know, countries like Brazil or Mexico or Argentina or even Colombia occupy a much more prominent place in the U.S. imperial agenda. But the European monetary system developed as a result of the discovery of silver mines in Potosí in 1545. So Bolivian mining was fundamental, in fact, to the development of a capitalist monetary system in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. And in the 20th century, it was one of the major providers of tin, as you mentioned, and one of the outgrowths of the development of the tin industry was the growth of a very powerful trade union movement, which was not only a sectoral movement, it was able to speak to larger social demands, not only the demands of the miners, but the demands of many other social sectors, and it was able to bring together many other social sectors in the Central Workers Federation, which was also broken after 1986. So Bolivia has this incredible history of trade union militancy and radicalism in the 20th century, and it was in fact Trotskyist tin miners who, their militias were the ones who defeated the army in 1952 and made the national revolution. But there's also another really important tradition in Bolivian history, and that is the tradition of First Nation insurgency. And there were moments like 1781, like 1899, where First Nations people demanded their own government, led by the Aymara above all. The Aymara had the strongest tradition of insurgency, especially in 1781, but also in 1899. And you begin to see the outlines of a completely different country in which Indians, as they call them in Bolivia, First Nations people, and actually I should clarify that when I say they call them Indians in Bolivia, it is the radical wing of the First Nations movement that has adopted that term. They've kind of retaken it from the colonizers, I guess. But the idea is that First Nations people would be the owners of the land and that they would be taking the political decisions that affect them instead of having other people take those decisions for them. So that would be one Bolivia, and you begin to see the outlines of that Bolivia of a completely different country in 1781 and 1899. So Bolivia has this incredible tradition of organizing and struggle and revolt. So
current events are not surprising at all when you kind of put it in that context.
No, I think it's very clear that since 2000, although we know more about Cochabamba and we saw more about La Paz in the news, the strongest, or besides the coca growers, the movement of the Aymara peasants is absolutely crucial because they emerge again in 2000 in a very rebellious and defiant way, blockading the roads and forcing the government to take steps back and... there's no question that you can't make sense of all of that without knowing that there's a tradition of hundreds of years, you know, that even influenced the trade union movement. In fact, if you want to look at how the trade union movement developed in Bolivia, you can see that this tradition of First Nations insurgency was very influential, and it kind of got buried for about 50 years, but you really see it emerge again in the after 2000.
So since February 12th, is it fair to say that there's been a period of relative calm, or is that a misperception because the mainstream media has, you know, stopped writing about Bolivia just as quickly as they started at that time?
Well, that certainly, there's no question that when things happen in Bolivia, it can be at most kind of a blip on the metropolitan media screen, and really even alternative media, you don't see a whole lot about it. Although there has been there have been some good articles posted by the folks at Indie Media from Argentina, and they've been translated into English and posted. But even in the alternative media, you don't see a lot on Bolivia. But as far as things returning to normal, it's funny because in Bolivia, as I said, in 1781, in 1899, there have been revolts of such magnitude that you can see the beginning of a completely different country, you know, revolution in embryo, something like that. And at the same time, you know, it doesn't work out. You know, it gets postponed. And then the next, you know, then it's as if it never happened. So there's kind of a long history in Bolivia, in fact, of these uprisings, revolts, near revolutions, failed revolutions, whatever you want to call them. And then everything supposedly is back to normal. But it's very difficult to tell, and I would say that while it appears, you know, the government dismissed, the president dismissed his cabinet, which was one of the popular demands, so he clearly had to take steps back, you know, in spite of the fact that there was terrible government repression. Over 30 people were killed just in those 2 days alone, and mostly by government sniper fire, in spite of the really brutal repression, which is unprecedented in Bolivia. In Bolivia, they don't kill people the way that they do in Colombia. Or in Mexico, for that matter. In Bolivia, when 30 people die in a day, it's really, you know, it's a very, very shocking number. And this is a country of only 8 million people. So in spite of the government repression, I would say that they did have to take steps back, and the president did dismiss his entire cabinet, which was one of the demands of the movements.
Did he dismiss them, or did they? Because I read they resigned.
They resigned.
Sorry, go ahead.
They resigned because they were going to be dismissed if they didn't.
Okay, and the new cabinet, are these, could this be called a more progressive cabinet, or will this be more of the same?
No, this will be more of the same. It's quite possible, though, that there may not be the kind of systematic repression. The repression might be a little lighter in this cabinet, but I could be wrong because one of the people who was appointed was responsible as the prefect of the department of Potosí. Bolivia is divided into 9 departments, and one of the departments is Potosí. In 1996, this person has just been appointed to the cabinet. He was prefect of the department of Potosí, and he was responsible for the massacre of some miners in a place called Amayapampa. So some of the people who've been appointed have some pretty sinister precedents, and leader of the Aymara peasants movement, Felipe Quispe, his response was, you know, they got rid of one group of killers, and then they bring in some people, you know, who are maybe even worse, you know, who maybe even got more blood on their hands. But my sense is that this new cabinet probably won't be able to act with the same degree of kind of sinister coordination against the social movements. My sense is they won't have the same degree of cohesion, which is only going to weaken the Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada administration further. I mean, I think I've tried to stress, but it would be hard to overestimate the weakness of this government, but its utter lack of legitimacy on almost any level. There are really very few people in La Paz who support this government, even though many people believe the, you know, media version of the, you know, it was a bunch of young teenage delinquent vandals. There's an interesting statistic that I want to give. They rounded up 180 people, and 60 of them were minors. But of those minors, only 3 of them had criminal priors. So the media representation of it as, you know, these kind of marauding bands of vandals was completely preposterous, but many people stayed at home, only knew what they saw on TV, so they believed it. And yet, even still, most of those people who were terrified by what they saw of looting and so on and so forth, and were very glad to see the police return to work, do not support the government. So there's, I don't see the government being able to generate legitimacy for any of its policies. It's all of its policies are completely discredited, and it has no alternatives to offer.
How likely is it then that Mr. Morales's party will I mean, what do you think is going to happen? You said that the current president likely will not survive the rest of his term, which I gather is another 3 years. How do you think he's going to be removed? Is this going to be... is he going to bow to political pressure, or do you think he's going to be forced out through further uprisings, as we've been witnessing there in the last couple of years?
It's very difficult to suggest more than a range of possibilities. To be more specific, it's difficult, but I do see that one possibility is an Ecuadorian-style uprising, because in Ecuador, they've overturned two governments since 1998 through popular pressure. The government here in Bolivia has shown that it's willing to use repression. The difference in Ecuador, of course, is that there's a sector of the army that's very sympathetic to the indigenous movement, to the First Nations movement. And now, of course, one of those military people is now president in Ecuador, and there are an unprecedented number of First Nations people in office in Ecuador. I wouldn't be surprised if there was an Ecuadorian-type popular uprising that overthrew the president, but the difference is that I don't see any sector of the Bolivian army being particularly sympathetic to the First Nations cause. But one of the things that was put on the table in April 2000 in Cochabamba was the possibility of a constituent national assembly. And it's an idea that Evo Morales, has given lip service to, but has not really prioritized in his agenda. And I think now what we see is a coming together of the different forces. I think it's fair to say that under the leadership of Evo Morales and his political party, but not so much his political party as what he has now dubbed the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And of course, he's the leader of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the only one who can really speak as a national opposition leader, but he has joined forces with the leader of the Aymara peasantry, Felipe Quispe. And as I said, even though the coca growers have been the vanguard movement against neoliberalism in Bolivia, without the support of the Aymara peasantry, who have the capacity to shut down the roads in Bolivia, the coca growers can only get so far on their own. Evo Morales can only get so far on his own. And that was what January revealed. The blockades in January revealed that Evo, by himself, could only get so far. He realized that, and he's kind of changed his strategy and is trying to build some unity. Now, whether that unity can actually be translated into practical, coordinated action between the different social movements is another question altogether. Another great weakness, which was revealed on February 12th, is that the movement towards socialism and Evo Morales and the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the people have absolutely no urban presence, not in La Paz. And they did not have any influence over the course of events on those 2 days. In fact, what was really remarkable for all of us who were there on February 13th at the march that was called was the absence of any presence of the movement towards socialism or Evo Morales. It was a complete and utter lack of leadership, and it was a spontaneous uprising that very quickly dissolved when the police went back to work. So one of the weaknesses facing the opposition movement is the coordination between city and countryside and the coordination between the coca growers and the highland peasantry. But if there is any type of coordination, if that type of coordination is achieved, it would really only take about 4 or 5 days to bring the government down. And I think pretty much everybody knows that here. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that there's some kind of what they call autogolpe, which is what Alberto Fujimori did in Peru when he dismissed Congress and, turned himself into a little dictator. There's a possibility that could happen here with military backing and a civilian facade. So there could be a kind of hardening of certain right-wing positions because, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada is proving himself to be completely incompetent in his second administration. So one possibility would be a kind of right-wing military-civilian coup, the kind of thing they attempted on April 11th, 2002 in Venezuela and failed to bring about.
I guess the where I'd like to end this is right now in Bolivia, situation, although there is obviously some tension, but it's actually for day to day life quite calm for people there right now. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, carnival's coming up, and carnival is, you know, the biggest event of the year. So yeah, for now things are calm, but I believe that another blockade of the roads is being prepared for April. And if there is coordination between the Aymara peasantry and the coca growers, such that the better part of the country is the roads in the better part of the country are shut down completely, things will not be very calm. So, you know, there is kind of I would say it's more of a tense stalemate right now than calm, or the government has achieved a temporary and not very overwhelming victory. But yeah, you know, to all intents and purposes, if you were a tourist here right now, you would, you know, you couldn't tell except if you walked past the Ministry of Sustainable Development and saw that it, you know, had been burned.
Did you happen to read in the paper the other day about what the EU has planned for countries in the developing world that presumably would include Bolivia? And has there been any reaction, any political reaction there?
The sense in Bolivia is that Bolivia is so firmly under the thumb of the U.S. Embassy, you know, and the proposed free trade agreement for the Americas and the entire U.S. imperial agenda, that the Europeans are almost irrelevant. They are politically irrelevant. In terms of, you know, development aid, of course, they fund all kinds of micro projects and NGOs and so on and so forth, some of which do good work, a lot of which, you know, just basically recycle European capital to European functionaries. But that's at the level of economics, really, and it's in terms of development aid that Europe makes its presence felt in the in Bolivia. Of course, the United States doesn't do development aid. The United States builds, you know, military bases in the region where the coca growers are. That's, you know, that's their development approach. So, the news about Europe here is, you know, I mean, people, I think Bolivia, many Bolivians would be thrilled if Europe was able to play some type of mediating role, if Europe was able to take up an independent position with respect to the issue of coca growing. I think people would be thrilled, but I think people are very skeptical about Europe's capacity right now to provide any alternative, you know, to U.S. imperial policy.
It sounded to me as if the European position was a just sort of a re-emphasis of the neoliberal agenda. Privatize this and privatize that.
And then we'll throw some more development aid your way. You know, you make it good for European business, don't favor only North American business. Of course, free trade of the agreement of the Americas is kind of a neo-mercantilist agreement, you know, where the United States is going to try to exclude all type of foreign competition. They will dominate Latin America almost completely if the free trade of the agreement of the Americas goes through. And Europe doesn't really have any, they're not offering any alternative to neoliberalism, but I would say in general they're much less resented in Bolivia, and you know, even though they advocate, you know, watered down neoliberalism or neoliberalism with a social face, whatever that might mean, unlike the United States, they actually do provide money for some types of development projects. So they have more credibility, of course, than North Americans. And I would say Canada is very much lumped in with the United States in terms of, you know, mining companies and their involvement in Bolivia.